Hello, 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 and welcome to Think Business Futures. I'm your host, Max Tillman. Coming to you from the studios of 2SER in Sydney on Gadigal land of the Eora Nation and right across Australia on the Community Radio Network. This program is run with the assistance of the UTS Business School, and each week we take a closer look at the numbers that make up the news. Well, you can deck the halls with Ford estimates. Christmas for the finance world has finally arrived, with the Federal Budget 2020 putting pen to paper on a fiscal year for the ages. And with a deficit to the piercing tune of $213 billion, this year's tea leaves do not paint a pretty picture. Can we hitch our recovery wagon to tax cuts? Will big spending in business add up alongside a continuation of social distancing? Well, as they say in economics, you can never judge a budget until it's at least a week old, which is exactly what we plan on doing today. Joining me to find out whether this financial Christmas we'll be getting a new bike or a pair of socks is Nicole Sutton from the UTS Business School's accounting discipline, Richard D'Abreu-Lorenco with the Centre for Health and Economics Research and Evaluation at the University of Technology Sydney, and Business School industry professor, as well as former ANZ chief economist Warren Hogan. At the heart of this year's budget seems to be quite a remarkable gamble by the government, sort of hedging their bets on a vaccine being available by the end of next year. Now, just to look at those eye-watering figures, the underlying cash deficit in 2020-2021 is expected to be $213 billion, 11% of GDP. However, it's expected to improve over those forward estimates to $66 billion in 2023-24 and down to $49.5 billion, which is 1.6% of GDP by the end of the medium term. So it's looking as though we have a recovery plan out of here, at least based on those forward estimates. So Richard, you're today's resident vaccine whisperer. So we'll start with you. All of these forward estimates are packaged with this understanding that we will have a vaccine, or at least that there is a concrete path to having one available. So just to start off this discussion, it's sort of its natural starting point. Is that a particularly dangerous assumption to make, particularly with those forward estimates showing signs of recovery in the economy?
Thanks, Max, and thanks for inviting me onto the program. Is it a dangerous assumption? Well, dangerous implies that we can predict with some sort of reliability or not that this is all going to fall over. What we know is that the government has put quite a large and substantial sum of money, $1.7 billion, towards two of the leading candidate vaccines, one from Oxford AstraZeneca and one from UQCSL. And they're doing that with the understanding that one of those candidate vaccines is likely, and I use that word in inverted commas, to show efficacy in its current clinical studies. Is it dangerous? Possibly, if it doesn't show that it's efficacious. And there's another possibly there, and that is that the Australian public don't take up the vaccine to the extent that the government would like. I'm sure Nicole is going to touch on how dangerous that would be to the forward estimates in terms of what we might see in terms of our recovery, but whether or not a vaccine actually becomes available is still a matter for contention. It's still an unknown. It's looking good, but we can't say that one is coming. We do have to point out that we've known about coronaviruses for some time, and as yet we still haven't developed a vaccine. When we last spoke, we talked about the global effort that's gone into developing a vaccine for a coronavirus. This time around, we've never seen a concerted international effort like we have this time. We are hoping that it will bear fruit, but until we actually see those vaccines and see the results of those trials in publication, we won't be able to say with any certainty I use that word in inverted commas, that we have a vaccine that we can comfortably roll out to the public.
Now, Warren, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, look, the main issue right now is that we have a substantial amount of government support in the economy, or have for the last 6 months. The main channel for that has been through the JobKeeper program, but there's also been the elevated JobSeeker, cash flow payments to business, and various other things. The bank moratorium, where basically SMEs and individuals who want to suspend or are under economic pressure can suspend their repayments on their loans. So The big issue is not so much do we need to do something more. The thing is we need to replace those emergency policies with something that's more sustainable from both an economic functioning point of view, as in to allow the economy to go back to the way it used to operate, where the private sector sort of was the main game for the Australian economy, but also from a cost point of view, those government programs are hugely expensive. So that's really what it's all about, you know, on the idea that, you know, we're still going to have an economy that's under pressure for at least another year. It's just about how to go from one set of policy supports to another, and to facilitate a longer term recovery. Putting that strategy, that issue that the budget addresses face on, you know, front onto the side, the question becomes, well, can you actually sustain a much heavier role for government in direct income support to the community for a longer period of time? So it might not be JobKeeper. It might be something more direct. That's effectively targeting it on people who are either already on social security programs or people with low incomes. And then, you know, that then becomes an ideological question.
People like Ned Kelly are our cultural icons, these bushrangers and outlaws. It does lend something to the idea that potentially if there's a national rollout, there may be many people who aren't really willing to get the jab on behalf of their civic duty. Do you think that it's important for that to be constantly raised in any discussion about forward estimates?
I do, Max. I think vaccine uptake is a very, very important issue because of the importance of population coverage, and that is what percentage of the population is actually vaccinated, the importance of population coverage to how effective it is. The more people that are vaccinated, the more effective that the vaccine is going to be in reducing transmission of the virus, of the coronavirus itself. If we have a large proportion of the population who doesn't take up the vaccination, then that will reduce the potential efficacy of the vaccine. Now, that is, of course, all affected by a couple of things. One is how effective the vaccine is itself. And we don't know that yet because we don't know the results from the clinical studies. On the flip side is people's willingness to actually be vaccinated. And you mentioned the Australian larrikinism and the Australian ideal of not necessarily always doing what we're told. Vaccination is an interesting example where we actually have very good immunisation rates for most of our vaccination programs. We have very high vaccination rates in most areas. The COVID vaccine is going to be an interesting case because we have already seen media stories where people have done surveys suggesting that perhaps in the vicinity of 60 to 70% of people might take up the vaccine. That suggests that the 30 to 40% will not. We have also seen we're coming off a case where people are not happy about quite protracted measures of lockdown and social distancing. So we're coming off a period of some social unease where people might not want to be told again, this is what you must do to stop the spread of this virus. So how that all plays out when governments might then ask people once again to be good social citizens and take one in the arm or the backside, wherever we're going to be injecting this vaccine for people to be vaccinated, that remains to be seen. And I might add, we didn't actually incorporate that into the budget. So there's nothing in the budget, as far as I can tell, about an awareness program and an education program and putting money behind getting out there and getting people vaccinated. So we're paying for the vaccines. We've got money in there to buy the vaccines from the manufacturers. But from what I could see from the budget papers, nothing about actually educating the public and making sure that we get the uptake we need.
And Nicole, obviously, it's understandable that there will always be optimism in a government's pitch to the public for what their budget contains. That's just politics 101. But to see that same optimism reflected in forward estimates, does that worry you at all, particularly when you look at this sort of fork in the road that we're presented with between vaccine or no vaccine? Does it worry you that maybe there hasn't been a full contingency plan, at least laid out in full in the budget papers, to explain what happens if this vaccine doesn't come to fruition in the timeframe that we're all hoping?
I would echo what Richard is saying in the sense that I think we need to understand what are assumptions that go into the budget. I mean, whenever we're forecasting in the future, we're going to forecast into uncertainty because we don't have a crystal ball. And so in that case, we have to make an estimate, we have to make an assumption, and we are going to be wrong. Like, we are going to be wrong in what that forecast is. I think the critical thing is for us to be able to appreciate what are the kind of the crucial assumptions and what those impacts are. Now, I'm sure in the depths of Treasury, they have got lots of different models with lots of different parameters will show the whole gamut, the whole array of different scenarios that play out given the timing of some of these measures. But I think you're right, Max, in the sense that it's tricky when you're communicating this to the Australian public about how much is, you know, how much we can bank on and how much we need to be a little bit aware of, well, this is all contingent, depending on a couple of key parameters.
As you've already mentioned, deep within Treasury, I'm sure that there are those working very hard to build these models. But I know it may sound a little bit high school, but do they ever show they're working to the public? Do we ever find exactly how Treasury have reached these forward estimates?
Well, actually, last year I went and I chatted with, I actually went to Treasury and talked to them about how they actually put the federal budget together. Because remember, on budget night, I mean, the people who get the show is the Treasurer and the Prime Minister. But really what's gone into making that has probably been, you know, 6 to 9 months of work and going back and forth between both the kind of the federal government, the different departments, the different stakeholders, Treasury, finance, and modelling these different things. I guess I would caution in terms of if we were to, I mean, the budget itself, if you were to print it out, is a massive document, right? And so if we were to have to do that, but do that with, you know, three different scenarios, I mean, that's going to be an enormous document that I'm not sure how much we are going to make use of. So, I mean, I have a little bit of confidence in the sense that I know that they are doing that modelling behind the scenes. I think to your point, though, it's about the messaging. And the messaging is, here's our best guess, but this is our assumption. And if these assumptions are wrong, then watch this space.
And we'll turn our attention to one of the crown jewels of this budget, the tax cuts. So the government's bringing forward its second stage of tax cuts, which means obviously millions of Australians will have more money in their wallets, potentially from the end of this month. So it's planning on, it has backdated the cuts to July this year. Now, it means people who earn between $45,000 and $90,000 will end up with an extra $1,000 in their pocket. But obviously, it'll benefit higher income earners the most, with people earning more than $90,000 taking home up to $2,500 extra. However, the statistics show that middle to high income earners are more likely to actually save that money as opposed to inject it back into the economy in the sort of stimulus way that we're all hoping. So once again, we return hitching our economic wagon to something, but are tax cuts able to get Australians engaging with the economy again, despite the fact that the budget also makes clear in black and white that social distancing will remain a reality at least until the vaccine? Do you think that it's difficult to reconcile those two?
Well, I think that's a really important question and one of the big issues in this budget. And I think it's one of the reasons they didn't do the stage three tax cuts, which we know will sort of have their biggest beneficiaries for middle to higher income earners, which of course, what's the point of that? They're already saving a lot because there's restrictions on what they can spend. So those tax cuts would have no real economic impact. So the question is the tax cuts that they've given, the other payments they're making, the incentives they're providing to business, is it going to work even in a COVID normal economy with social distancing and border closures and this sort of thing? And look, I think it can. I think people are are finding new ways to spend. And the reality is for low and middle income earners, you know, overseas holidays, going out to expensive restaurants, or even going out to eat a lot are not necessarily part of their normal activity. And so I think that a good chunk of this money will be spent. But it is an uncertainty. And the other thing is, everyday Australians, in fact, people all around the world, businesses all around the world, are faced with more uncertainty than I've ever seen in my sort of 25 years of looking at the economy and the outlook. That in itself is a reason to be conservative and save a little bit more. So we have to wait and see. But the government has so far showed its ability to target in and support those who are most impacted. And I'm sure if things don't turn out as well as they're currently expecting in this budget, that they can pivot again, and that they can provide that direct income support if it's needed, in the form of a higher job seeker, a one-off payment to job seeker recipients, more payments to pensioners and other social welfare recipients. So there's still room to manoeuvre.
Now, Nicole, you've also been busy taking a closer look at the $2 billion boost in additional research and development tax incentives. From everything you've gathered, there's a whole lot more going on than just your regular tax break. So could you explain what you've found?
Yeah. So the R&D tax incentive, I mean, it's fascinating stuff, right? This is the thing that's going to keep you up at night. It's played a bit of a game of hokey pokey over the last few years where, yeah, some years it's in and some years it's out. You throw it in, you throw it about. So what's kind of it? Again, it probably slipped under the radar because, I mean, it's only an extra $2 billion that we're throwing this way in the next kind of 4 years. But what's interesting is this was one particular area of reform that the coalition government, they brought in 2 years ago because of a review of the R&D tax incentive. Okay, bit of context. The way in which this government supports innovation, or the Australian government supports innovation, the biggest plank of how they do that in this country is actually through this tax incentive to business. So it comprises about a third of all the money that governments spend, you know, on science, on tech, on, you know, on sending to public research agencies, the research funding it gives to universities. A third of it, so its biggest kind of plank in its policy, is to provide a tax incentive to businesses, where in the sense that they get some of the money back from the government on the money that they spend on R&D. So a couple of years ago, in 2016, the Turnbull government launched an inquiry just to check whether or not this was actually, you know, it was delivering against the program objectives. And so they convened a review, 90 submissions from businesses, from consultants, from people within the innovation ecosystem. And they came up with a couple of recommendations saying that the program needed to be tweaked so that it was better targeted to the areas that are likely to deliver those innovation benefits that they're looking for Australia. And so a couple of tweaks, they brought in a cap on the amount of kind of cash that could get refunded to smaller organisations, and they brought in this tiering system for large organisations, which basically meant that for organisations that were spending a lot more of their money on R&D, they got a bigger offset, which kind of makes sense because you want to be rewarding the companies that are doing R&D really intensely, as opposed to the ones that are just doing it as a very small part of their operations. So they brought in, you know, I was in the budget in 2018, and they brought in these four tiers for large organisations and this cap for small organisations. 6 months later, when it came to legislate, the government balked a little bit in the terms of the start dates. They pushed back the start date by a year, and they said, oh, you know what, 4 tiers is a little bit tricky in terms of, it's a little bit complicated for large organisations. Let's simplify it. Let's make it 3 tiers. And now 18 months later, what they've done is that cap that was on the cash that would be paid back to small organisations, that's gone. And those 4 tiers down to 3 tiers are now just down to 2 tiers. And so if you look at what's happened over the course of, you know, 3 or 4 years, we're actually back at a point by which the kind of incentive system is ostensibly just as, if not potentially more generous than the one they had before. Now, it's not my job to, I don't want to slam or kind of, I don't want to have a go at the government putting money towards innovation. I think that's great. And in terms of ways to stimulate our long-term economic recovery, I think funding innovation generally is a fantastic idea and a great way of spending money. I guess the thing I'm thinking is that, you know, again, is this the best way by which we can get what we're looking for? And what was interesting in that, as part of that review they did a few years ago, some economists looked at the incentive in terms of the amount of money that's going to private businesses, and they considered, you know, the cost benefit of that, particularly in relation to other ways you could spend that money, you know, like, you know, funding other research programs. Now, it's really tricky to see with when you're dealing with innovation policy, it's really hard to see the benefits or to measure the benefits because there's so much unknown. So they tend to kind of develop different models with different parameters and so on. But what was interesting was that they said, compared to spending this money on other research programs, the money going towards a business tax incentive could be, it could come out on top. Yeah. Could come out on top. But what was interesting, it was only when the parameters were set at the best case. So what do we take away from that is that, you know, in terms of where the money goes, if we wanted to stimulate, in this case, innovation, well, giving money to businesses to pay for their R&D or to pay a portion of their R&D expenditure could have a net benefit. It could be better than, for example, putting money into other research programs through the universities or the CSIRO. But only if our assumptions of how that tax incentive works is in the kind of the best case scenario.
The capacity for this government to break through its ideological constraints, particularly in the early phases of the pandemic, I think highlighted something more about the Australian character than anything to do with politics. And that is, Australians are highly principled people, but at the same time, we're ruthlessly pragmatic. It's part of the success of the country. And getting that balance right in our political life, in our business life, in our personal life is a real hallmark, I think, of Australia. And that's what they did. And if this means that going forward there won't be this sort of complete focus on balanced budgets, and I do think that the government went a little bit overboard on that in the last couple of years. I think we could have done a bit more strategic fiscal stimulus in order to support the economy ahead of the pandemic. It wasn't going to happen under that government's watch because they did want to get a budget back into balance. And I just don't think that's going to be the same imperative on this government or any government now for the next decade, if not more. So I think it is a big change. But the really big issue is not that capacity to use fiscal policy. It's about how you use it. And I hope we're also going to see a continuation of the use of the government's financial power to address inequalities, unfairness in our community. And look, they do that, and we do that as a civilized society, but I think we've done that a lot better in the last year. And I think we need to continue to, because I think one of the sort of handful of major challenges to our society and other democracies is inequality.
We'll let you make your own mind up on today's analysis. Once again, thank you to Nicole Sutton, Richard Diabria-Lorenco and Professor Warren Hogan. Make sure to catch the full unabridged version of this conversation wherever you get your podcasts. And most importantly, don't spend your tax cuts all at once. I've been your host, Max Tillman. Thanks for listening.
the valley below me. In the valley below. They all pretend not to know me. They all act like they don't know. In the sky above me. In the sky above. Mama, all the stars are broken. For either me or you or us. In the valley below me. In the valley below. We all pretend not to know us. They all act like they don't know. In the sky above me. In the sky above. Mama, all the stars are broken. For either me or you or